Civic Forum's board, Dr. Joseph Nye. You have a bio for Joe on the table, so I'm not going to bore you with all of the information that you can read. I will just tell you that if you go on Google and put the word soft power, if we had a dollar for every time, every hit, we could also run Pacific Forum for 2 or 3 years. So Joe was the one who coined that term and who has continued to define it. With former Deputy Secretary of State Rich Armitage, he then, part of a CSIS commission, coined the term smart power, which was used about a dozen times in Hillary Clinton's congressional testimony and which has been used many times since then. He's been identified as probably the leading intellectual in the United States on foreign policy. We are deeply honored to have him as our chairman and extremely grateful that he's with us tonight, Dr. Joseph Nye. Joe?
It's also a pleasure to be back at a meeting, a board meeting of the Pacific Forum. It's really quite extraordinary what this organization has been able to do. I was talking this noon at lunch with Joe Vasey, and he said that when he started this organization in 1975, it was a period when there was a general belief that the United States was leaving Asia. This was in the aftermath of Vietnam, the feeling that we are drawing back. And he had a feeling that there was a need to knit together people, to bring Americans and Asians together, to indicate that that was not the case. And if you look what's happened with this idea that he had and take it forward to today, it is an extraordinary organization that we see, which has had meetings in something like 28 meetings or conferences in 8 different countries over the past year, which publishes first-rate materials. There are 2 PACnets every week. I was saying to Ralph Kosa that unlike a lot of things, when they come across my screen and I push delete, I always read these because I learn from them. An organization which has developed a network of young leaders, which is really, truly impressive. I mean, having talked to them at various meetings and breakfasts over the years, it is encouraging. It makes you feel that there is something there in the future. And they do all this on, about $1.8 million budget a year, which is unbelievable. I mean, so in that sense, to come back to Hawaii is a pleasure, but to come back to the Pacific Forum doubles the pleasure. I'm really proud to be a part of this organization. But I'm going to talk to you tonight about something that's a little bit more difficult than praising the Pacific Forum, and that's the relationship between China, the U.S., and Japan. And quite clearly, we're going through a different and difficult spell now. We've seen in the last 6 months or so difficulty in this triangle of relationships, a triangle which is essential if you want to the vision that Joe Vasey was trying to create and establish when the forum was started. Now, if you think about China and the U.S. right now, you'll see that we're in a bit of a rough spell. Taiwan, arms sales, questions of how we're going to deal with issues of sanctions on Iran, their whole monetary issues and so forth. There's a large, long list. And the most recent, of course, is the issue of the arms sales to Taiwan. There's a very good PACnet note by Bonnie Glaser on this, but to some extent, we have to realize that the way the Chinese see it is a little different than the way we see it. I was reading a statement by Jin Kanrong, who I've always regarded as relatively reasonable And it might, I'm going to read this in, for your quotation, or direct quotation, so you get some idea of how they see it. And he says, the real purpose is to make Taiwan a long-term geopolitical card to constrain China's development. In order to realize this purpose, the United States has to ensure Taiwan is in a state of neither unification nor independence, so as to maintain its ability to intervene in Taiwan's political affairs and cross-strait relations. On the one hand, the United States actively seeks cooperation with China in some fields, while on the other, it is adopting a containment strategy against China in fields including human rights, the Taiwan question, arms sales, and trade. Whether that's right or wrong, that is a perception which indicates that we have considerable difficulties. Now, that's interesting because if you compare this with, let's say, a year ago when we were having our board meeting, notice the change. Notice that essentially, if we were looking at it a year ago, Hillary Clinton was talking about the fact that we're all in the same boat together, that China and the U.S. would, in her words, rise or fall together. Notice that Tim Geithner, the Secretary of the Treasury, was saying that he spent more time consulting with his Chinese counterparts than with any other country. There was an expression, I think a dumb expression, called the G2, which said that U.S. and China were going to solve the world's problems, dumb because it ignored the importance of Japan and Europe. After all, Europe is a larger economy than the U.S., much less China and Japan. But nonetheless, there was a feeling that things were supposed to be going in the right direction. But notice that even before the visit of the Dalai Lama or the Taiwan arms sale, things had turned in a different direction. At Copenhagen, not only was China not cooperative, but they were deliberately insulting. For Wen Jiabao to be sitting in his hotel room and send an underling to meet with the heads of state, including President Obama, is not just a slight or an inadvertent missing of a meeting. It's insulting to have a Chinese underling point his finger and shout at the American president in a meeting is very insulting behavior. And these things don't necessarily happen by accident. In addition, you have when the Americans are trying to develop sanctions against Iran to persuade Iran not to develop a nuclear weapon, and you have the Russians cooperating, and you have high-level meetings of every country in the P5 plus one, the permanent five members of the Security Council plus Germany, and the Chinese send somebody who has no instructions because he's so low in rank, that's also insulting. There's something odd about the behavior that we've seen recently. And in that sense, it's quite a contrast between the feelings that were present at the beginning of the Obama administration of how there was going to be cooperation between China and the U.S. and what we've seen in the last 6 months or so, or 3 months probably. Now, what happened? There are people who know the answer to this much better than I, but I speculate that it's a combination of two things which are almost polar opposites. One is a Chinese sense of insecurity. There has been a crackdown in China across the board on bloggers, on human rights activists, indeed even on lawyers who represent such people. And that may have something to do with two transitions that are going on in China. One is a political transition as we approach 2012, and the feeling that in a period with rising nationalism and uncertainty, of desire to have more political control, sense of insecurity. The other, which has been suggested by Bill Emmett, who's the former editor of The Economist, is that we may be approaching an economic transition, that the Chinese growth model, which is export-led growth, is coming to an end. As the U.S. savings rate rises to approximately 5% now, essentially it means the amount of consumption of Chinese exports that used to be typical can no longer continue. And that, in turn, means that China has to do something different. It either has to increase consumption at home or it has to export less abroad in a way in which you will have concerns about the current employment patterns, which depend upon state-owned enterprises, which get particular subsidies from the government. That, if the Chinese elite is beginning to realize that they're going to have to make an economic transition, because the growth model they've used so successfully over the last several decades is coming to an end, that could also be a reason for insecurity, which could explain some of their behavior. The other possible cause of what's happened looks like it's almost the opposite. It's hubris and overconfidence. In a sense, because China recovered so well from the economic crisis, much better than other countries, and has a high rate of economic growth, and holds so many American dollars in their reserves, there is a feeling that the balance of power has shifted. And you can read in a number of Chinese writings a view that the Americans aren't what they were. Indeed, you can see a number of statements by Chinese academics and others saying that the United States is in decline. And in such a world, we can essentially do as we wish. We don't have to be as deferential to the Americans as we have been in the past. So you have essentially two things happening on this view at the same time. Though they appear opposite, they may reinforce each other and produce the behavior we've seen. One is domestic insecurity and external hubris or overconfidence. Now, I happen to think if that's what's happening, and I emphasize that this is speculation, since nobody knows for sure, I think it's a serious miscalculation on China's part. First of all, I don't think the United States is in decline. I'm writing a book on this, a book that I'm going to title Smart Power, but the gist of it is that the Americans go through cycles every decade or two about thinking we're finished, we're done, we're in decline. I mean, after Sputnik went up, that was the end. After Nixon closed the gold window in the 70s, that was the end. After we had the Rust Belt problems in the Reagan period, that was the end. After the financial crisis, this is the end. I don't believe it. But, you know, whether that's right or wrong, you'll have to read my book to get the answer, but whether it's right or wrong to predict, as the Chinese are, that the Americans are in decline, I think is a serious miscalculation. The second is the view that because China holds so many American dollars, that they then have leverage over us. I think that's also a miscalculation. We are indeed thoroughly interdependent with the Chinese in the economic area. But whether there's power in an interdependent relationship is not from the interdependence, it's from the asymmetry or the unevenness in the interdependence. If I depend on you and you depend on me, and we depend equally, you don't have power over me, I don't have power over you. But if you depend on me more than I depend on you, guess who what? I have the power. And in the China-American economic relationship, there's tremendous symmetry in the interdependence. Yes, China could sell dollars and bring the American economy to its knees, but in doing so, it would bring itself to its ankles. Basically, China would not only lose the value of the dollars that it's holding, but would create a situation where it would lose access to the American markets, which are essential to keeping the high employment, which is essential for political stability inside China. So if the Chinese think that now, because they have so many dollars in reserve, that they have power over the Americans, that's a serious miscalculation. And the third miscalculation, I think, is what a senior Asian statesman said to me recently, which is they've forgotten Deng Xiaoping's advice, which is hide your light under a bushel. They've taken the basket off too soon, if this is what's happening. And that means that you're going to have reactions of other countries to the rise of Chinese power, which you might otherwise not have had. Well, if this is an accurate diagnosis, and as I said, it's only speculation, since nobody knows for certain, then what should we do? And the answer to that has two dimensions. One is a tactical dimension, the other is a strategic dimension. Tactically, I think the fact that the Americans have become somewhat tougher with China in the last few months is correct. I think there is a point that's made by the political scientist Robert Axelrod that says if you want to get cooperation and the person you're playing with is not always cooperative, the best strategy is a tit-for-tat strategy. If you cooperate, I cooperate. You defect, I defect. And that tit-for-tat eventually produces a situation where both sides see that in the long run, it's better to cooperate. If we simply say, I cooperate, you defect, I cooperate, you defect, all you're doing is essentially encouraging the other side to defect, to essentially not cooperate. So in the tactical sense, I think the meeting with the Dalai Lama and I think the arms sales to Taiwan are correct. To have deferred them or not gone through them would have been a serious mistake. So in that way, I think that tactically what we've seen recently is a correct response. But I think it's also important to distinguish tactics from strategy. Strategy is how you look at the long run. In a strategic sense, we have to ask, where do we want to be with China in the long run? And that takes me back to how we design the strategy that's informed American policy toward China for about the last 15 or 16 years or so. In 1994, when I was chair of the National Intelligence Council, and Ezra Vogel, my colleague, was the National Intelligence Officer for East Asia, we were asked to do an intelligence estimate about the future of China. And we looked at a series of potential futures. Remember, there's never one future. The world is full of futures, and you try to describe a number of them and assign relative probabilities to them. And as we looked at them, it was pretty clear that on most of them, not all, but on most of them, China was going to continue to grow impressively. That basically, with a 10% rate of economic growth and an 18% rate of military expenditure increase, that it was plausible that, as Goldman Sachs has speculated, that China would have a larger economy than the United States by 2030. Perhaps it's 2040. Who knows what the exact point would be. But if China was going to rise this way, we needed to ask, what were we going to do? How were we going to respond? And one possibility was to try to contain China, to create an alliance around China which would stop it. Another was to try to slow China's growth, a little bit like we did with the Soviet Union during the Cold War. We regarded both of these as not very plausible. Instead of that, what we said was we should look for a strategy which can bring China into the international system, but hedge our bets in case it misbehaves. So we argued that we needed a strategy which was to integrate but hedge. And in that sense, what we argued was that the rise of China was likely, not completely certain. It's never correct to have a linear projection of the future. China could stumble on a variety of things. But probably that the rise of China would continue. And what were we going to do to respond to it? Well, the Chinese, it looked like, were very concerned about economic development first, because legitimacy for the Chinese Communist Party and the elite that runs it depends upon a high rate of economic growth. With the end of a belief in communism, except as an official point, what was then an ideology pulling the country together was being replaced by two things, ethnic Han nationalism and high rates of economic growth. And in those circumstances, it seemed that what we were likely to see was a situation where China would indeed continue its peaceful rise, because an external environment which was disruptive would undercut that Chinese economic growth, undercut the legitimacy of the Communist Party, and be too dangerous for them. So it seemed likely that at least until 2030 or whatever, that China would avoid major external disruptions. Now, there are always accidents like Taiwan could produce or other sorts of things, but our projection was that they would indeed seek what they used to call a peaceful rise. But the question was, what would happen in the future? I mean, Hu Jintao told the 17th Party Congress that China needed to increase its soft power. That's smart for China, because if your hard power is increasing, you want to disguise it with your soft power. That gives us leeway in the short run, but it does leave open the question of what happens if, when China gets strong, they say, now we're strong enough, we can essentially take the bushel off our light. We can remove the basket. And that was the importance of the hedge. In other words, try to integrate China, have them join the WTO, try to make overtures to get them become what Bob Zelick called a responsible stakeholder. But if for some reason in the future that didn't fit, how were we going to deal with that? And that led to the feeling that it was very important to reaffirm the U.S. security treaty with Japan. If you thought about a balance of power in East Asia, there were three countries that were major powers: U.S., China, and Japan. And if you ask in any kind of situation where you have a three-party game, is it better to be part of the two or the one? Well, the answer is better to be part of the two. In that sense, if U.S. and Japan, faced with a rising Chinese power, kept their own alliance tight and close, it meant that China would have fewer options to play U.S. against Japan or Japan against U.S. In other words, by reaffirming the U.S.-Japan alliance, we could shape the environment into which China was emerging. And that was the general argument of the 1995 East Asian Strategy Security Report, which is integrate but hedge. I think that has actually been a successful bipartisan strategy. The Bush administration followed it, and I think the Obama administration is following Bush on this. But the question that's arisen recently is, has the change in Japan endangered the strategy? Last August 31st, I guess it was, we saw for the first time, well, almost the first time, except for the Hosokawa interregnum, first time in a half century, a replacement of the Liberal Democratic Party by the Democratic Party of Japan, a major shift in Japanese domestic politics. And the people who came in with the DPJ had not a lot of experience in government, to put it somewhat mildly, and they had appealed on a rather populist program for election, which included slogans like developing a new East Asian community, a more equal alliance, and in appealing for votes in Okinawa, changing the Futenma air base on Okinawa, and the deal that had been reached in 2006 with the LDP. Now, that has created a fair amount of turmoil in the U.S.-Japan alliance over the last several months. But my own feeling is that this is not likely to be a showstopper. I don't think it's going to derail the strategy. First of all, and this won't be popular with all my friends who are in the Marine Corps, Futenma, while it's important, is a second-order issue. I had been chair of the Special Action Committee on Okinawa, and that was so long ago we've almost forgotten it. But we've been concerned about what to do about Futenma for a long time. A regiment was made in 2006, which is a reasonable deal, indeed a good deal. But when the new party came in, the Democratic Party of Japan came in, because they campaigned against it, it became a salient issue in Japanese domestic politics. At first, we thought that we could push this through. And in the process of pushing it through, we ran the risk of creating a cause celebre in domestic politics. First major political change in Japanese politics, and what are we doing? We're saying, unless you do things our way, Uncle Sam won't help you anymore. Not very good in terms of developing a broad base of support for the alliance. Fortunately, that's begun to change, and Washington is now becoming more patient and not pushing quite so hard. I think the result of this is that the U.S.-Japan alliance will survive this change in Japanese domestic politics. And I say that not because there's an easy solution to the Futenma issue. I don't know how Futenma is going to turn out. But I say it for three reasons. First of all is the problem of North Korea. The Japanese have to ask, how are they going to deal with a nuclear North Korea if they don't have an American alliance? The second is the rise in the power of China. How are the Japanese going to deal with the rise of China if we let the American alliance atrophy? The second point is the Japanese, if they wanted to deal with these two problems, Korea and China, could. They have the wealth to support a large military. They could develop nuclear weapons relatively quickly, but it would be very expensive for them, expensive economically and politically. I doubt that Japan and Japanese public opinion wants to spend 3% or 4% of its gross domestic product on military investments. And so I think in that sense, Japan can't afford to let the American alliance atrophy. And third, if you look at the idea of an East Asian community, that there's going to be this new relationship with China, which is part of the DPJ rhetoric, it's not clear what that means. Closer economic relations, yes, but economics is not security. I once used a phrase when I was in the Pentagon that said that security is a lot like oxygen. You never notice it until you start to miss it. But once you don't have oxygen, you can't think of anything else. And in that sense, if the Japanese think that they can live in a relationship in East Asia, which will be based on a close economic relationship with China, while preserving their full political independence, I think they'll run into that problem. So I think, in fact, because of the changes that we've seen recently at the tactical level, but more fundamentally because of these underlying realities of the structure of power in East Asia, that the U.S.-Japan alliance is going to survive, and survive in relatively good shape. And if that's true, then so too will be the longer-term strategy I described of how do you deal with East Asia as a triangle, which essentially is the issue of China, which was to integrate but hedge. So if I ask what is the implication of this in conclusion, I would say there are a few things that we should draw lessons from for policy. One is to be very careful about nationalism, whether it's nationalism in Japan, in other words, don't stir up a nationalistic reaction against us by tactics that are not productive, and don't stir up nationalism in China, which is already strong for reasons I gave earlier. So think about the effects of nationalistic reactions as we design the tactics we use. Second is make major efforts to reaffirm the U.S.-Japan Security Treaty in this year, its 50th anniversary. We should use this 50th year to get a new declaration of the importance and centrality of this U.S.-Japan security relationship. If we don't, it will be a terrible missed opportunity. Third is to illustrate that we're not trying to contain China or prevent it from growing. See if we can develop ways in which you can have trilateral or perhaps quadrilateral cooperation between China, Japan, U.S., and Korea. Energy is a clear area there, and energy efficiency, energy security. These are areas where there are joint gains in the relationship. So that doesn't have to be just negative, it can also have a positive dimension. Fourth, we should essentially keep in mind that shaping the environment in which Chinese power grows is going to be the secret to what happens. We have no idea what will be in the minds of Chinese leaders 20 years from now. We now think they care about development more than other things and that they are not going to disrupt the external environment. But who knows what the successors of their successors will be thinking? And in that sense, what we do know is that we can shape the environment in which the successors of their successors face the world. And what that's going to require is dealing closely with Japan, as I've described, but also with India. There's a very interesting book by Bill Emmett, who I mentioned earlier, former editor of The Economist, called The Rivals. And it says, you know, everybody's focused on the rise of Asia. True, Asia will rise in the 21st century. But Asia is not one thing. What's most important to realize is that India and Japan are much closer to and much more worried about the rise of Chinese power than we are. And what that means is when they look at the rise of Chinese power, who do they want to help them? The United States. That gives the United States an extraordinary power advantage. So in that sense, if we think in terms of shaping the environment, things which include Japan and India and their own working together are very important, not to contain China, but to shape the environment in which China is emerging. And that then brings me to my final policy conclusion, which is the importance of focusing on long-run strategy, not to let short-run tactics of this or that issue get in our way, but to look at what's the kind of Asia that we want to see in 20 or 30 years. We can live with a stronger China. We can profit from a stronger China. But it depends upon our shaping the environment in which that stronger China emerges. And part of that shaping is to educate a younger generation of leaders to see that there can be a joint gain or positive sum outcome for the future of Asia, in which you can have security and prosperity together. And that's one of the things which I am so proud about of what the Pacific Forum does, which is we are, I think, not only holding the conferences and meetings, but training the younger generation of leaders who will see the world this way. So thank you very much. Well, you now have ASEAN Plus One, which essentially is the free trade agreement with China and ASEAN. I was in Hanoi a month ago, I guess, and met with the Prime Minister and talked about this. It's a mixed blessing. I mean, the ASEAN nations are pleased to see the opportunities for increased markets. They're also worried about the question of whether Chinese will take over their markets. So I think there will be a closer relationship here, but I don't think it's going to be a takeover. I think as one thinks about the larger questions of architecture, what kinds of organizations and institutions there'll be in East Asia, what we're going to see is what's sometimes been called in Europe variable geometry. You're going to have ASEAN plus one, ASEAN plus three, ASEAN plus six, with different names to them, East Asian Summit or whatever you want to call it, but that's good. There shouldn't be one organization of all of East Asia. Having several different frameworks, I think, is healthy, at least for our interests.
David?
Joe, what's Russia's role likely to be in all of this?
Well, the Russian question is something of a puzzle. If you look back to, let's say, the period of the late 80s, there was a general feeling that Russia was a key player in East Asia. Vladivostok was going to be a central power point, focal point, so forth. Now, in fact, you find that Russia is preoccupied with Europe and Central Asia and has not really played that much of a role in East Asia. And if you look at the number of Russians who live in the Asian part of Russia, it's something like 6 million or so. It's tiny. And the Russians have a puzzle, which is they very much want to have good relations with the Chinese because they're concerned about the Americans. They also want to make sure that the Chinese don't control Central Asia through the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. And they want to sell military equipment to China, but they don't want it to come back and hurt them in the future. They want the profits now, but they don't want the threat later. And they also have a concern about selling oil and gas eastward, so the Europeans depend on them more because it means that the Russians have another outlet. But they don't want it to be something where the Chinese have control. They'd rather have it go to an LNG terminal so that it can go to a variety of different sources. So the Russians are profoundly ambivalent for all these reasons about how they play their hand in East Asia. And I would argue that so far it's not been a skillfully or powerfully played hand. Well, on the question of architecture for East Asia, I think the United States has an interest in keeping APEC going if it's become somewhat sleepy in recent years. But APEC signals the American role in the Pacific. In other words, that we're part of it and that we can think in trans-Pacific terms, not just in terms where the Americans are excluded. So I would hope the Americans will continue to focus on APEC. There is an argument that can be made that the Americans should also spend more time on the East Asian Summit, what you might call the plus six. We decided not to join that. Having Australia, New Zealand, and India as part of it essentially protects our interest. But it's at least an open question about whether we might want to be become part of that as well. I think the major concern is to make sure that that you don't have a situation or an architecture in East Asia where China becomes dominant to the point that other countries can't do much about it. On the question, the second question you asked about young leaders and how academic and policy issues interrelate, I've long held that one of the problems is that when academics get too divorced from policy issues, or when policymakers don't spend enough time thinking about longer-term questions that academics sometimes raise, both sides suffer. And so the talk that you heard me give in New Orleans last week was an indication of that. It seems to me that the nice thing about the Pacific Forum Young Leaders is that it includes both. Well, I think our policy toward Taiwan should be, and this is pretty standard, no formal declaration of independence and no use of force. And within that, no force by the mainland, no independence by Taipei, that you leave the two sides to bargain out the situation of the type of relationship they're going to have. And I think that means that we have to provide enough arms so that China cannot feel that it can suddenly have a fait accompli by military force. And I think what arms we sell to Taiwan under the Taiwan Relations Act has to be in terms of that, what's inside that box that I described. And I think that has to be assessed at different, you know, each time you look at the balance across the strait to see what would it take to make sure that Taiwan couldn't be quickly taken over by military force. And I think that is the basis for which we make a decision, whether in a particular circumstance we need or shouldn't sell F-16s, I would leave to an assessment at that particular time. In other words, I don't think there ought to be an automatic formula. I think it's going to take judgment of what is necessary to make sure that Taiwan can protect itself from a sudden takeover militarily from the mainland, so that there is then an incentive for Beijing to negotiate with Taipei.
Let me just close by again thanking you all for coming, reminding you that if you haven't gotten your validation sticker, to please see the ladies on the way out. If you're not currently receiving our PACnet newsletters and other products from the Pacific Forum, please leave us your name and address, and we're more than happy to put you on our mailing list. The easiest way, of course, is just fill out the donation form and your card, and just leave that with us, and we'll be happy to get back with you. Thank you all very much for coming, and please drive safely going home. Thank you.
Well, there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. Professor Joseph Nye, very well-known Harvard professor, clearly a person who has played a very significant role in the formation of American policy towards Asia, clearly one of America's great strategic thinkers, always well-organized, insightful, and informative. A couple of the key points that he made that I thought were interesting was his opening comments about the strains in the relationship between the United States and Japan. And, of course, this is a very, very important relationship to the U.S., one without which the United States' role in Asia would be greatly undercut. However, Professor Nye thinks that things will work themselves out once the governing party, which hasn't been in power all that long, sort of settles down and really gets its feet on the ground. He seems to think things will go better. And moreover, if one thinks about the potential security threats facing Japan, North Korea and its continual experimentation with nuclear weapons and long-range missiles that possibly could hit Hawaii and are clearly of more concern to Japan, it will be cause to impel the Japanese to straighten up the relationship with the United States. Moreover, there's always the China military buildup. No one really knows what China's long-term intentions are. I think it's safe to say, most people would say that it clearly wants to run the show in Asia and wants to be the regional power, and that's not particularly an idea which the Japanese embrace. Moreover, for Japan to replace the military benefits that its relationship with the United States provides them would be costly, time-consuming, and there would be a lag time, a period of lag, before those benefits could really catch up and equal the situation today. Japan has gone through some very rough economic times in the last decade or so, and probably wouldn't be up to expending the additional amounts of money necessary to provide that same degree of security as the United States supplies. If we think about the situation in Okinawa, the continuing feuding over the base realignment, while Professor Nye didn't allude to this, some others have suggested that perhaps what should be done is those 8,000 Marines that the United States has offered to move to Guam, perhaps they should be moved to the Republic of Korea. And perhaps the Futenba base, maybe that should be moved to Korea as well. The Koreans, it seems, especially under the administration of Lee Myung-bak, with whom the United States government has a very good relationship, would probably welcome those troops. And when one thinks about it, a large number of the U.S. military assets positioned in Japan really are there to intervene in any situation that might evolve on the Korean Peninsula. There was no mention of a free trade agreement, the pending free trade agreement between the United States and Japan. Between the United States and Korea. And clearly, this is something which the Koreans really want. They're just about to sign an FTA with the European Union. It does seem that American businesses would lose out. On the other side of the coin, if the FTA between the United States and Korea were signed, it would create, it is said, additional jobs in America, and I think everybody knows the unemployment rate is unacceptably high in the U.S. these days. Moreover, it would strengthen the bilateral relationship between the United States and Korea, and right now, as I see it, that's the strongest bilateral relationship the United States has in the region. China. Professor and I talked about a two-pronged approach to China. One was the continual attempt to bring it into the international system, to make it a responsible stakeholder. And as ideal as that might sound, one wonders just how far down the road we've traveled on that. The previous administration clearly coined the phrase a responsible stakeholder. Clearly aimed the concept of China, but one really has to question how far that has proceeded. We're really not getting a whole lot of help from China with the nuclear situation in Iran. They were not helpful at all at the Copenhagen climate control talks. Dug their heels in on the exchange rate, although admittedly they might be letting up on that at the present time. Appear to want to change the international system in a manner that would benefit China. And, of course, there's the ongoing military buildup and the accompanying lack of transparency. So one only has to wonder just how likely it is that China will become a responsible stakeholder. My own personal inclination is to believe that China wants to play the game its way on its terms, not necessarily in league with others. On the other side of the coin, Professor Nye offers the notion that we should, while on one hand try to bring China into the international system, we have to build a hedge against it as well. And as I interpret it, that means building stronger bilateral relationships with countries in the region. And clearly, those bilateral relationships became somewhat frayed during the Bush administration, given its excessive focus on the Middle East. China, on one hand, can be viewed as a country that's a bit cocky these days. It sees itself as having come out on top of the global economic situation, believes that that is substantive proof that its system far outpaces and exceeds others. And also, I think it's fair to say that China is still riding very high on its obviously very highly successful Olympics, as well as the pageantry of the 60th anniversary of the PRC, and its growing clout in the world. Yet, on the other hand, looking at China from a more domestic perspective, one can see that there are definite problems. There's the unrest in Xinjiang, the unrest in Tibet. The internal unrest that seems to be pervading the country due to a relative economic slowdown. Last year, there were 100,000 civil disturbances reported in China. That is 20% more than the previous year when there were 80,000. So it's a sort of a contradictory message. Yes, on one hand, China is acting very cocky due to its growing international influence, yet it's acting in a very insecure manner, on the other hand, due to its ongoing domestic problems. I had the opportunity to ask Professor Nye about the potential sale of F-16 C's and D's to Taiwan. He had, in his comments, said that he supported the recent arms sale to Taiwan, and he also was in support of the visit of the Dalai Lama to the White House. Yet, he did hedge, I believe, on the question of the F-16 sales. To me, it's something that should be done. It should have been done a long time ago. The Taiwan Air Force is less credible than it was in the past. It's to sell the high-performance aircraft to Taiwan would only further stabilize the region, and that is a key goal of U.S. policy in East Asia. Some say that if the aircraft are not supplied to Taiwan, then Taiwan has the potential to start to develop nuclear weapons. And given the number of MIT physicists running around Taiwan, that is clearly a possibility and not a stretch of the imagination. So thank you very much for joining us on Asia in Review, and we'll see you next week.